Penguin Random House Audio presents Churchill and Son by Josh Ireland. Read for you by Jonathan Cowley. For Ivy and Victoria. Prologue. Winston Churchill's hands were very white, delicate, and slender. So slender that the triple banded signet ring he liked to wear would sometimes slip from his fingers. One person who met him during the Second World War was surprised that a pair of such soft hands was holding off the Nazis so forcefully. He was not alone. Many people, when meeting Churchill for the first time, were confounded by his hands' beauty, especially as he grew older and the rest of his body became coarse and bloated. Winston knew this and was proud of it. He could laugh off most insults but was hurt by a Punch cartoon in which his hands appeared podgy and shapeless. "Look at my hands," he complained to his doctor, Lord Moran. "I have beautiful hands." Another thing people noticed was his hands' constant motion. The way he held his cigar between the first finger and thumb and rolled it untiringly around the rim of his coffee cup without seeming to have any idea what he was doing or his habit of breaking matches. Small, restless hands were a feature he shared with his only son, Randolph, who resembled him in so many ways. When Winston looked at Randolph, he knew that he had given him, or encouraged within him, the best elements of his own personality. Kindness, originality, eccentricity, heedless bravery, and a flamboyant disregard for anybody else's opinion. He would also have seen colossal faults, arrogance, recklessness, an uncontrollable temper, and a perplexing weakness for self-sabotage. There were other people about whom Winston Churchill felt as tenderly as he did his son, and there were other people who provoked in him insensate rage, but Randolph was the only person in his life to elicit both emotions. He could draw from his father thoughts that read almost like love letters. "I have been very remiss in writing to you, but that is not because you are not constantly in my thoughts. I have so many things to tell you that I hardly know where to begin." And yet he was also capable of making him so angry that those watching worried Winston would have a heart attack. Randolph got under his father's skin, and in doing so, he left him exposed and raw, prey to gusts of emotion that he could not control. It was Randolph in whom his father confided his fears, plans, and secrets. Whether they were friends or enemies, they could sometimes be both during the course of a single dinner, Winston was never more himself than in Randolph's company. Randolph was glorious in his own way, a giver and devourer of pleasure. The kind of man who exploded into rooms, trailing whiskey tumblers and mischief. He was born beautiful, blessed with eloquence, energy, and a photographic memory that allowed him to recite verbatim whole passages of classic literature and history. When Randolph was young, his father encouraged him, praised him, told him that the future was his to seize. Winston was determined that his son would not suffer the same neglect that had blighted his own childhood. He was also determined that between them they would build a dynasty to equal any in history. Winston was obsessed with his son, but he was also consumed by his own sense of destiny, his belief that fate had singled him out for a higher purpose. Everything and everyone were secondary to this. Randolph, whose loyalty to his father was so extreme that it came to hinder almost every aspect of his existence, would learn this to his cost. This audiobook is the story of their lives together, and how Winston built and broke his son. Chapter 1. "Do try to get Papa to come. He has never been." One night in November 1947, Winston Churchill was sitting in the long dining room at Chartwell with Randolph and his daughter, Sarah. There was a gap in the conversation, which Randolph filled by suddenly pointing to an empty chair and asking his father, If you had the power to put someone in that chair to join us now, whom would you choose? Randolph and Sarah sat back, expecting Winston to say Julius Caesar or Napoleon. Instead, he thought for a moment and then, very simply, said, "Oh, my father, of course." Winston followed this by telling them a story. On a foggy winter evening, he had been copying a portrait of his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, when just as he was trying to capture the twirl of his moustache, he realized that he had materialized before him, looking as I had read about him in his brief year of triumph. Father and son talked about the ways in which the world had changed since the elder man's death, and the great events that had taken place, until the apparition suddenly said, "I was not going to talk politics with a boy like you, bottom of the school, never passed any exams, except into the cavalry. Wrote me stilted letters. I could not see how you would make your living on the little I could leave you and Jack, Winston's younger brother. But then, of course, you were very young, and I loved you dearly. Old people are always very impatient with young ones. Fathers always expect their sons to have their virtues without their faults." As the conversation progressed, it became clear that Lord Randolph assumed his son had lived an undistinguished life as a mid-ranking army officer. "You should have gone into politics," he told Winston. "You might even have made a name for yourself." With that, the apparition lit a cigarette. As the match flared, he vanished. Neither Randolph nor Sarah was sure at that moment whether Winston was recalling a particular dream or elaborating on some fanciful idea that had struck him earlier, although in the months before he had complained of endless nightmares in which Lord Randolph had appeared to him. But the story, which his family called The Dream, and which Winston referred to only by its original heading, Private Article, left both brother and sister hugely excited, and they urged their father to commit it to paper. Over the next few months, he worked obsessively at drafting and redrafting it. Then, for reasons he never disclosed, Winston locked it away in a private box for 10 years. It only emerged, Randolph wrote, just before Winston's death, when he scribbled some final changes on the manuscript. That Lord Randolph was on his mind even as his own life came to a close is not surprising. Winston never stopped thinking about the man he had hero-worshipped ever since he was a boy. He was, Winston would later say, the greatest and most powerful influence in my early life. A fearless, dynamic politician who died at the age of just 46. Winston learned his father's speeches by heart, took his politics unquestioningly from him, and every step in his own career was accompanied by an insistent voice wondering whether Lord Randolph would have approved of the decisions he made. The problem was that while he was alive, Lord Randolph barely spared his son a second glance. Lord Randolph cut an unforgettable figure. His head was large, his body short and frail, his walrus moustache was extravagant, and he was addicted to dressing loudly, but what struck those who met him most deeply was the pair of bulging eyes that gazed uncompromisingly back at them. He suffered from exophthalmos, which caused his eyeballs to protrude and made him seem as if he was looking at the world in a supercilious, offensive fashion, which in truth he generally was. When he wanted, he could be charming and funny, but more often, especially when confronted by those he did not know or disapproved of, he slipped into a glacial aristocratic hauteur. The second son of the Duke of Marlborough, Lord Randolph had struggled at Eton and began his time at Oxford badly. He drank, broke windows, and chased women. "I don't like ladies at all," he said. "I like rough women who dance and sing and drink. The rougher, the better." And yet he also possessed certain gifts. His memory was extraordinary. He could read a page from, say, Gibbon, and then repeat it verbatim. He was clever, quick, and witty. These gifts were sufficient to...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?